Welcome back to the New Books Network's African American Studies channel. I am your host, Adam McNeil. Today, our guest scholar is Dr. Annalisa Cox. We'll be talking to her about her new book entitled The Bone and Sinew of the Land, America's Forgotten Black Pioneers and the Struggle for Equality, published by Public Affairs Press. Welcome to the show, Dr. Cox. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm glad to be here.
Likewise, I am very happy to finally have you on the program. It has been it's been a process to get us up here to recording, but believe me, I am sure that it's going to be well worth it, and we're going to do very well. Folks are going to learn a lot about this particular topic. And so before we get into the book, can I ask you what prompted you to write The Bone and Sinew of the Land? And can you give us a quick a history lesson of the particular reference that the first part of the title alludes to?
Well, you know, I didn't think I was writing this book when I started off writing it. I assumed, as most historians did, and I actually assert this in my first book, that the rural regions of the Northwest Territory states were relatively homogeneous, right? Historians have long known that this region that we now call the Midwest, at one point it was called the Great West, but originally it was the Northwest Territory. So this was our nation's first free frontier. The 1787 Ordinance of the Northwest Ordinance actually set aside this region as free from slavery, which made it the largest piece of land in the New World at that time to be set aside as free from slavery. But it also had equal voting rights. So there was something interesting going on in this region. Historians knew that by 1860, there were over 60,000 African Americans who were living in that region. And Stephen Vincent, in his excellent book, pointed out that most of those African Americans seemed to be rural, but nobody had figured out where exactly they were living and what exactly they were doing. So I wanted to find out, because in my first book, I was doing a very Geertzian deep study of one particular community in the 19th century Midwest. But I began to suspect that there was more going on in this region, especially after I went on book tour. And it really, no matter where I went, whether it was Miami, Florida, or Portland, Oregon, invariably somebody would come up to me in the book signing line and say, "Well, I'm sure you've heard about this community that my great-great-great-great-grandparents came from, or that community." And I hadn't. And not only had I not heard of the community, but it seemed that nobody had heard of the community. So as I began digging, I began to find more and more of these settlements. And it really was a situation where this is a history kind of hidden in plain sight. It is not like these communities were trying to be secret. Some of them, some African Americans in this region were, for very good reason, because after the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act, it became very, very dangerous for some people to be counted on a federal document. And other activists in that region were protesting federal government and not allowing themselves to be counted, even though they were legally there. John Langston was certainly one of those. But this was, when I started this out, I really thought that I'd be lucky if I found a couple dozen. And I remember being really excited when I found over 30, because at the time it was assumed that there were maybe five or six. By the time my exhibit opened at the Smithsonian Museum of African American History and Culture a couple of years ago, I was able to identify about 80 settlements, and that's on the map that's on the wall of that museum. By the time the book went to press, I had found over 300. And by So this was our nation's first great migration. This was a movement of tens of thousands of free African Americans onto the Northwest Territorial frontier, often starting in the 1790s, 1800s. They're coming out and they are purchasing the best land from the federal government. They're often first, I've the number of times I've come across African-American pioneers who are literally purchasing land deed number one in a particular region of this territory, I was just stunned. Whether it's Western Wisconsin or Eastern Illinois along the Wabash River, this is what they're doing. So they're there early. They're getting good land. They're establishing themselves. They are there for a long time, and they have astonishing levels of wealth. And they are using that rootedness and that wealth to organize and to create extraordinary levels of resistance to the rising inequality and injustice that is occurring around them. As to your second question about the title of the book, the bone and sinew of the land is actually, that particular phrase comes from an open letter written by a group of land-owning, successful African-American pioneering farmers in Ohio, in and around a community called Carthagena, Ohio, which was actually founded by an African-American pioneer who was not actually unusual, but amazing, and I would say heroic, in that he was a freedom entrepreneur. I coined this term to describe the people who worked while they were enslaved to raise usually a fortune in money to purchase themselves. And then once they did, they often turned right around and purchased members of their families. And this community founder did just that. He purchased his family for the just astounding amount of over $2,200. This is around the 1820s or 1830s. And then he founded the community of Carthagena. So this is an open letter that was sent to the residents of the cities of Ohio, the African-American residents of the cities of Ohio, saying, leave the cities where you are being oppressed, you're being burned out, you're being attacked, you're being mobbed and murdered, and come to the rural regions, come to and become farmers, become the bone and sinew of the land. So I loved that quote. And then just around the time the book was going to go to press, I was appalled to discover that the term bone and sinew men was actually coined by President Andrew Jackson, which, yeah, that's a problem. because President Andrew Jackson, and as my book makes very clear, and his goals were at complete odds with the goals of African-American equal rights activists and their white allies at this time. It was actually a term that he coined in his retirement speech from his presidency, the term bone and sinew men. But in the end, what I discovered was that African-American equal rights activists, particularly in the Midwest, whether we're talking farmers in Michigan or farmers in Ohio or farmers in Indiana, are publicly using this term in convention speeches, which they're then publishing widely around their states and their region. They are taking that term, they are converting it, they're owning it, and they're recycling it to make a claim for their primacy, for their citizenship, for their right to call themselves Americans, and the fact that they are the ones who are actually deeply rooted in this land, that they were there first, that they are there and doing successfully well. And so in the end, after a lot of fraught conversations with my editor, we decided to keep it because we loved what these equal rights activists were doing with this term.
And that particular background is tremendous, because when I think about the history that you tell in the story, I think one of the more intriguing parts is, you know, how, you know, the book that really got me to want to really read your book and definitely take the opportunity to read it, digest it, and ultimately interview you for it was because when I worked at Fort Scott National Historic Site in Fort Scott, Kansas, there was a book that I picked up actually. There was actually a sale. It was either a sale for a book or something. I discovered a book, nevertheless, from Dr. Quintard Taylor out west.
Yes, and he's been doing amazing work out there. Yes.
Tremendous work. I think he's at University of Washington. I think he might be emeritus by now. But he wrote the book In Search of A or the Racial Frontier. And that book just blew my mind because I'm someone living, you know, in that important state of Kansas, though, interestingly enough, you would politically today never know. It was the kind of the story that brought it into the Union. But that's a whole nother story. But nevertheless, it opened up my mind, Dr. Quintard Taylor's work, to Black pioneers. Mm. And so what it also made me think about was how, you know, kind of the narrative, you know, kind of like why have Black pioneers been really marginalized in the overall Western expansion narrative? And also somewhat maybe even in the historiography of it as well.
Yeah, I would say that there's definitely been I think there's been a triple hit against this particular region, because it is the Midwest, which has been assumed to be homogeneously white for so long. Mm-hmm. And of course, as Quintard Taylor and others have pointed out, the myth of the frontier and the pioneer has always been described as white, right? But I'd say that took particular hold for this particular region, which is the first and earliest of our frontiers, right? The Northwest Territory was before the Louisiana Purchase. This, we went to war, to Revolutionary War, to win this region, which George III had denied the American colonists when they went to fight the French for it in the 1760s. So this has particular sort of centrality in early America in terms of national identity. So the fact that people of African descent were out there early and doing well, even fighting in the War of 1812. One of my favorite couples, I wasn't able to focus on them. There were so many. Here's the problem. This is a movement, right? So this is, when I say it's the first great migration, I'm not joking. I want to impress upon people, this is not about just one person or two people or sort of a few exceptional people who are sort of rising. This is a movement. It literally integrates this region. The map that I have at the front of my book is actually a very conservative map because it only shows settlements that were home to land-owning African-American farmers. It doesn't show the mill owners or the general store owners or the blacksmiths or all of the kind of rural entrepreneurs who were successful and doing well at that time. And I want to stress here, statistics are difficult. You know, I understand statistics are important to historians, and they're a way of understanding the past, a way of understanding the landscape. But when looking and thinking about the history of race relations in America, particularly this region, statistics can be problematic. And here's why. This is a very, very visible pioneering group. They're also extremely successful. So say you have a county where there is just one African-American farming family. And I came across counties where there were that. In most cases, as I point out on this map, these are not just one farmer. These are settlements with a dozen families, or Cass County was 600 people. So you had a school and a church and a real community. But in some cases, it was just one farmer. But in those cases, it was often an immensely successful and wealthy farmer. I'm thinking about the Allen family in Illinois, who were actually one of the wealthiest landowners, black or white, in that county. And very quickly after settling in their county, that family owned close to 1,000 acres of land. And that farmer was hiring the local white justice of the peace to tutor his children to read. And also the economics of farming at this time, this is before the reaper, this is before any sort of mechanization of farming. So I had to really understand what pioneer farming looked like. Of course, it was an extraordinary amount of labor. So grain labor, grain was by far the most profitable of what you could grow. Hogs and corn were important too, but there was real money to be made from grain. And a lot of these farmers were not just subsistence farmers, they were market farmers. So for this particular family, if they had a few hundred acres under cultivation in grain, a healthy male farmer who really was skilled with a scythe could harvest about a quarter of an acre of grain a day.
Wow.
Yeah, that's not much. So that means that if you have a few hundred acres under cultivation, that at harvest time, you are hiring, and all everybody around you is white, that means you're hiring all of the able-bodied white people around you to harvest your grain. I mean, in some ways, this was almost a landed gentry situation, right? So the economic impact and the visibility of a farmer like this far outweighs their actual statistical numbers. I remember watching Hidden Figures, that movie that came out recently, right, about these women who were mathematical and engineering geniuses who were working at NASA. And there's an amazing scene where one of these geniuses is invited into a top secret meeting filled with white men, right? So if a statistical historian parsed out that room, they would say, well, there's only, you know, she only constitutes a very small percentage of African Americans in the population of that room. But as she is doing her calculations on that board in front of all those white men, her symbolic importance and sort of power far outweighs her actual numbers. And that is what I am seeing on this frontier, is that one incredibly successful or wealthy mill owner or general store owner or one of these landed gentry farm families, their numbers far outweigh their importance far outweighs their numbers. So there's a sort of a symbolic importance, which then helps us to understand the extraordinary violence of the legal and social backlash that occurred against this population.
And that, you know, seeing that kind of history is pretty interesting to me, because what I also think about is where in the context of African American migratory movement, right? One of the things that you touched on as well was kind of what were the, I guess you'd say, that many of the people who did, many of the African Americans who did move out into the what was then the Northwest Territory, not all of them were free, were they? From the reading of your book, it seemed like some of them might have been, were some of them enslaved, or were they not fully free laborers?
Well, there was certainly slavery illegally occurring in this region. And I do follow the extraordinary story of Cornelius Elliott, who was brought into the salt mining region of Southern Illinois, which was pretty much hell on earth. I mean, we think of the frontier as being wilderness and woods, and but mining is a form of industrialization that was like highly industrialized frontier work. and the salt mines of Gallatin County, Illinois. There were all sorts of legal loopholes created to allow for the enslavement of people, because bluntly, this was such deadly and horrific work that you couldn't pay people enough to do it. So, and there's been actually a fair amount of research done on the history of slavery in Illinois. And one of my colleagues, Dr. Heerman, is coming out with a really excellent book in August on the history of slavery in Illinois. So I won't go into that too much.
Yeah.
But because bluntly, what was going on, what I was capturing and intrigued by is this rising backlash. So the Northwest Territory had equal rights. It's a 5-page document, and the word white never shows up in it once. This is deliberate. It actually follows the model of the newly revised North Carolina state constitution, where they removed the word white on who could vote to open up equal voting rights. In fact, in 1792, as I point out in my book, when George Washington ran for president for a second term, the vast majority of states, slave and free, in this nation, as well as the Northwest Territory, had equal voting rights. And then you start seeing this backlash occurring. Ohio is the first state that is carved out of this region. And in 1803, whites, who outnumbered the earliest and successful African-American pioneers in that region, voted and created a state constitution that had white in it as defining citizenship. And I find this really interesting because they weren't willing to get rid of the part of the ordinance that said it would be free of slavery, but they were willing to erase equal rights. And what one really sees happening in this region is that there were two dichotomies before the Civil War in the North, particularly in the Northwest Territory states. It wasn't just slavery versus freedom. It was also equality versus prejudice, or equality versus injustice. And that second one was, while it's intertwined with the first, is separate and is important. And I think that these pioneers really reveal the importance of that struggle for equality that is occurring before the Civil War.
And also, I thought one of the more profound portions of your book, Dr. Cox, was, you know, you had mentioned the convention movement, and, you know, as we had mentioned before offline, that politically, I thought one of the more interesting parts about your book was how you have, and you mentioned this before even, where most people, when they think about folks who are moving to a particular place in this period, that it seemed that prosperity would have been better had in urban areas, right? That the urban areas were the areas where freedom could have been most would have been strongest, right? But one of the cool parts about your book, I think, was that wasn't necessarily the case in this particular region, in the states that you're looking at here, and not only that, but when you go to the conventions movement, as well, you know, that really the convention movement was, you know, very, very not only strong, but it could be, you know, could be said it was, really began there as well. And so I definitely appreciated that part of the book and learning about that particular history well before I started to get involved with the conventions, Colored Conventions Project through the University of Delaware, where I'll be going to school in the fall.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think we think of cities as the great melting pot. And also, we've long had an assumption, just sort of a post-Civil War assumption, that African Americans in the North were primarily urban and African Americans in the South were primarily rural. I mean, they're both disenfranchised, right? But mm-hmm. that's been the setup. That's been sort of the paradigm. And to be fair, through most of the 19th century, Northeastern African Americans were primarily urban, but Midwestern, Northwestern territory African Americans were not urban. In fact, many of them were coming out to this region before there were cities. I mean, long before there was a Chicago or, you know, what we'd call a city of Detroit. They might be in Fort Detroit, which is a very different thing, right? So this is a really different way of thinking about it. And the cities of the North, both the Northwest and the Northeast in the 1830s, were hit by a level of violence that was truly appalling. And it seems to have swept almost every major urban area of the North during this period. This wasn't just Boston, New York, and Philadelphia or Cincinnati. It was everywhere. I mean, Alton, Illinois is known for, you know, the death of Elijah P. Lovejoy, but his was just one of many attacks. And while his murder was held up, he was sort of this glorious and admittedly very handsome white abolitionist who was murdered trying to defend his press, there were many African Americans who were actually murdered, lynched, and killed during this period in cities. So there was, while not perfect, the rural and frontier regions of the Northwest Territory offered spaces for advancement to occur that could not occur in the urban areas of the North. There was not space for them anymore. The segregation and the color line were actually violently being created in the cities of the North during this time. So there's a reason why Oberlin College occurred in a small rural community of Ohio. Right? There's a reason why John Langston was the first African American to be elected in a free and open election to political office in this United States. And he was living on his 200 plus acre farm in rural Ohio at that time. When schools were literally being burned to the ground or pulled off of their foundations in cities of the Northeast, from New Haven, Connecticut to New Hampshire, there were revolutionary schools being built in the cornfields of Indiana where African Americans and whites, boys and girls, were in elite pre-collegiate institutions being prepared for a life in college. And Union Literary Institute is one of my favorite examples, but it was by far not the only one. So despite the backlash that was occurring in the Northwest Territory states, the terrible loss of rights, the right to vote, the right to testify against a white person in court, which is particularly debilitating for white entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial farmers, there were still spaces where African-Americans and African-American whites were working to uphold those founding principles that all men are created equal, right?
Mm-hmm. And that's so profound, because there's so the one of my mentors, she's a scholar of early Black education and Black education 19th and 20th centuries, and learning about the history of Black education and how important and how strong it was and still is in this particular region. And it's so profound. I never thought about the fact of how Oberlin, I knew that it wasn't in the city per se, but it never really occurred to me that it was a rural area, that Oberlin College, which has been, you know, largely like that liberal bastion throughout its history up until now as well. You mentioned, you know, John Langston and really that Langston name being so important, not only in this particular time frame, but also going towards the end of the 19th century, going into the 20th as well. I think is very profound, too. So could you tell us, you talked about the schooling part. So that's very institutional. What were the other institutions that African-Americans built in the former Northwest Territories that you speak of?
Well, first I want to add, just to be fair, Oberlin College, like much of the Northwest Territories, experienced its own form of backlash. And there's been a brilliant book that's been written about this. And actually, by the 1890s, much of that school was segregated. This was a great sorrow and distress. But the housing and even the halls started to become segregated at Oberlin. So the what was rising in this country and in the Northwest Territories, what we call Jim Crow, right? And we identify that as being Southern, was also occurring in this region as well. There is no, it is not a coincidence that the Klan rose with such ferocity and such vast numbers across all of these Northwest Territory states, because in many ways they are continuation of the kind of prejudice and racism that had been rising in that region starting in the 1820s and 1830s. But back to the question about institutions, churches, churches were a major, major part of community building in the frontier and rural Northwest. And the both the Baptist and the AME church were a very important part of the connections and ties between these communities. So there's been a lot that's been written about Quakers, right? And their movement into this region, often bringing African descended people with them. But I've come across a number of examples of not so well studied, but of Baptists coming up into this region in the 1800s, 1810s, founding integrated churches, African-Americans being founding members of these churches as early as 1806, strongly abolitionist, strongly pro-equality. This was something that was really sweeping the nation at this time. And then you had the rise of the AME church, along with backlash when a lot of these African-Americans were being forced out of the white churches they'd been attending for years, or those churches started segregating. They no longer, you know, they didn't want to sit in the back pews. They started to found AME churches. And Bishop Quinn was a huge part of this. He was coming out in the late 1830s. And by the 1840s, he had founded over 40 churches in this north, in these Northwest Territory states. And he was, he was an astounding figure. Any of you are fans of Django Unchained, this is who I think of, right? So he was beautifully dressed. He'd always wear white gloves, and he was extremely good horseman. And he loved to ride a half-wild white horse. And he would come galloping into town, and he would make the horse rear, and he would jump off his back as it was still rearing. And he would start either singing a hymn or preaching as soon as his feet hit the ground. I mean, it must have just been an astonishing sight. He had incredible courage. He traveled from St. Louis down into Louisville, Kentucky. He was all over the Northwest Territory states, and he was helping to tie these communities together through faith.
And that's a really cool particular culture of reference with Django Unchained. And so I definitely appreciated that one. You know, and institution building, I think, is one of the more profound aspects where, you know, when you try to think about how do people, and I spoke to Dr. Martha S. Jones about this with her new book on race and rights in antebellum America, on how do African Americans throughout all the struggles that they deal with, for honestly forever, but particularly to the periods that we're speaking about here, but how do they develop their own personal politics of belonging, because they are thwarted in way, or not necessarily thwarted, but there are so many barriers that are put up against them, where it's like you have the public perception of what the United States is supposed to be and what our founding principles are, but through lived experiences, how do African Americans coalesce that kind of, it's not necessarily a dichotomy, but that the overall messiness that's involved in it. And you know, I think one of the more profound areas of your book in the total sense is that I would say that, your book stands to answer of some of those questions through how you create, you know, your work here. And that's definitely much appreciated.
Well, you know, one of the things I was really surprised to see is that when these African-American equal rights activists are speaking out in the 1830s and 1840s, they're talking about lost rights. They're not just being utopian minded. They're not just saying, hey, you know, remember the words of the Declaration of Independence. They're actually saying, remember the rights we had under the Northwest Territorial Ordinance that were stolen from us. Like, they are, odd as it may sound, because a favorite term among historians to talk about this, what I call the second wave of abolitionism in the 1830s, is to describe people as radical.
But right. Actually, oh, yeah. Oh,
right.
Yeah.
But what if instead they're conservative? And the young Lincoln, in his first ever published speech, refers to this, right? He's referring to the outbreaks of mob violence that are happening, whether it's happening in Alton, Illinois or St. Louis, even against African Americans. And he's saying, maybe it's our generation turning its back upon the values that the revolutionary generation, who's now dying, describes them in this beautiful language as pillars toppling, right? It's not just beautiful language. It's actual pillars. It's actual sort of legal and political pillars that are falling. One of the most heartrending scenes for me to write about in this book is this African-American pioneer who comes into Indiana in the late 1830s, and he's having to register himself and his daughter. And he stands in front of that white county clerk, and he wants to tell that clerk, I voted in North Carolina. In other words, he was a property citizen, and until 1838, you could vote in the state of North Carolina if you were free African American. And there's that same sense of loss for African American pioneers in the Northwest Territory. They refer to it in speeches in Ohio in the 1840s that these are rights that have been stolen from them. So in some ways, they are the conservative ones. And it is the new generation of the mob, the sort of mobocrats, pro-slavery, pro-inequality, pro-injustice generation that is rising during the Jacksonian period, who are, could be considered the radicals, right? Not conservative.
Mm-hmm. And that, wow, that particular conception is really, 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 really cool, because, you know, like you mentioned before, so many people conceive of the 1830s and the simmering 1840s as, you know, like you said, that second abolitionist period, but also that word radical. It's almost like, you know those words that are just so overused that it seems like it loses its importance, right? If everybody's characterized as radical, then nobody can really be radical, right?
It makes the movement, it decentralizes the movement by calling the second wave of pro-equal rights and abolitionism radicals, instead of tying them to the first abolitionist movement of the 1780s and 1790s. It makes them outsiders. We're very interested today in the idea of who belongs, who doesn't, who's an insider, who's an outsider. And if we lose the fact that, and obviously it's important to talk about our founding fathers, right? It's important to talk about who they were and mm-hmm. what they were thinking and what they were doing. But I am also really interested in the ways that the founding citizens of this nation, Black and white, were interpreting the Constitution, the Northwest Territorial Ordinance, the Declaration of Independence in that first generation, in the 1780s, 1790s, and 1810s. What were they doing? on the ground with that stuff, regardless, because obviously our founding fathers weren't monarchs, right? They were creating this bizarre thing called the Democratic Republic, however imperfect it was. So if what we're seeing playing out in the Northwest Territory and the Northwest Territorial Ordinance of 1787 are the best ideals of the revolution, then we have to take that into account when we think about the founding ideals of this nation.
Very, very true. Very true. Another question that I had for you about your book was how when it came to, you know, as the period begins to shift, right? The politics of the nations begin to shift. You spoke about the Jacksonian period. So, you know, the late 1820s, 1830s, and that goes into the 1840s, right? So as time changes and the nation gets larger, you start to have wars, right? You have the Mexican-American War. The nation is beginning to expand again. Were there any particular changes and strategic changes as well, and anything in the sense of the activism changing in any way as the time periods begin to push further and further to what would eventually be the Civil War, though the folks in that time did not necessarily know that that particular moment would occur?
Well, when we think of the Civil War, I have to say, I often think of the pre-conflict as being, you know, Bleeding Kansas or something.
But oh, yeah.
So many of these conflicts were breaking out in the Northwest Territory states long before this. So Illinois in the early 1820s had a constitutional crisis that there were battles breaking out. I mean, people were being burned in effigy. There were mobs because there was a strong move right after the Missouri Compromise to make Illinois a slave state. Okay, so this conflict is already, it's already starting to break out in this region. And I think that one of the things we have to remember is the Northwest Territory actually saw the largest movement of human beings in a ever to occur on this planet in a very brief period of time. So between 1787, and I'm not the first historian who noted this, I'm just retelling it, right? Between 1787 and 1837, roughly 4 million people came to this region. This was astounding, right? It's amazing the planet didn't tip a bit when this happened. So if there's anything we can learn from what happened during this period, especially keeping in mind that African Americans were pioneers, were some of the earliest and most successful, they're very, very early as whites begin to move in around them, is that racism in this region, and I would argue that racism in America before the Civil War, arose in the face of Black success, not in the face of Black failure. This is really, really important to remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is actually a very good concept to remember, especially when we try to, you know, because I think the unfortunate part about history and how it's being a lot of times presented is in the timeline aspect. But this is a useful way to really ground people as well. And one of the parts too that I wanted to speak to you about as well was you have, you know, there are a lot of stories of very powerful women in your book as well. And before we get towards the concluding areas of the book, I'd love for you to speak about some of the very, very important Black women characters that are involved in the maneuvering in your book as well, if you don't mind.
Yeah. So women are really central to this narrative for a lot of reasons, and central to this history. They were central in the life of the nation and this region during this time, because the vast majority of people were farmers. In the early Republic, Sure, there were mines and there was some industry, but this is basically pre-industrial evolution. Mm-hmm. So the way to get ahead in America was to own good land and farm it well. And that was a family project. And I found it fascinating. I came across a diary written, a sort of travel account written by a very wealthy New York City native who traveled out to visit his son in the early 1820s out to Vincennes in right along the Wabash River in western Indiana. And he was astonished by how many women he saw working. And he doesn't talk about race. He's just saying, yeah, there's just women out in the fields and there's women doing this and women doing that. So it is, there was just a lot of, it was very difficult to have a farm if there wasn't a family. I did actually come across a number of women who were running farms on their own, who were head of household, whether widows or just even on their own, African-American women. But African-American women were also leaders in this early movement in really astonishing ways. One of my favorites is Polly Strong, who, like as Manisha Sina points out in her wonderful book, The Slave's Cause, it was often enslaved people themselves who were enforcing new constitutions when states started abolishing slavery during this period of the fervor for freedom in the early republic. And Polly Strong was one of those women in Indiana. She was held illegally enslaved through a loophole dealing with the early French population in that region. And when Indiana became a state in 1816, it really and firmly abolished slavery. Unlike Illinois, which had very gray and fuzzy language about slavery when it became a state in 1818, a very different court system there as well. But in Indiana, she decided that she and her family were going to be free. And this took so much courage, particularly for a young woman to do. She was held enslaved by a man, very, very wealthy and powerful, French trading family, who traveled between Vincennes and Fort Detroit. They were Michelin Mackinac. They were just all over the Northwest Territory, and they held people enslaved. And she was determined to be free. She was determined her family, her mother, her brother were going to be free. But she also faced terrible, terrible repercussions. And there's subtext to the court's response to her that make it very obvious that they understand the threats that she had undergone. There's more explicit ones in Illinois where the enslavers of some of these women who are petitioning for their freedom describe, I just beat them a little bit to get them to not do this, right? But there's just terrible tortures that can be done to a young woman to force her to back off of a court case like this. But she teamed up with a young white lawyer called Amory Kinney, and they were really determined to overcome slavery in this state. And while Amory Kinney, who was white and male, and the law protected him at this time, his life was being threatened for taking this case forward. He's very open about the fact that this happened. I can't even imagine what kind of threats and tortures that Polly Strong was undergoing. But she, even after her case was, she lost her case in Vincennes, she continued to take it on all the way to the state Supreme Court, where the Chief Justice actually quoted the sort of first lines of the new state constitution, which basically re-said the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal with an equal right to a life of liberty and happiness, pursuit of happiness, when he told her that she had won her case and slavery and all forms of bondage were thus finally overcome in the state of Indiana. It wouldn't have happened without Polly Strong.
And that particular story is why I'm for one glad that I asked the question, but then also that you chose that particular story, because to let the viewers in on a quick secret, there are many different stories of Black women that that Dr. Cox could have chosen from in her text, and so I'm definitely appreciative of this, and so.
Yeah, because I also
going into know, the
yeah. I just want to say I also, of course, follow the farming women, like Keziah Greer, and Nancy Lyles, people who were pioneers and farming. It wasn't all the farming life and life as a pioneer frontier person. Isn't all about court cases. It isn't all about battles, but it is its own struggle for survival. And their roles are very important as well. It was one of, I have to admit, Adam, it's one of the biggest challenges of writing this book. We're talking about tens of thousands, you know, tens of thousands of people, hundreds of settlements. Each of these settlements deserves a book. Each of these families deserves a book. And one of the biggest challenges of writing this book was being forced to skim, right? Because this is basically a brand new field. I think it would take 100 historians, 100 years to even begin to do justice to it. I can only hope that more historians start working on this history, because it needs work.
And you hear that, budding graduate students like myself and others, you know, you gotta call and hopefully you shall respond, like the tradition says. Because as you say, that there's so many, you know, as the folks who will definitely pick this book up, you'll see that, you know, you begin your book with the map, with the data set that you spoke of about the total settlements, and for the states of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Michigan, you have the different plots. But also, I think the cool part is to really let people know, because I don't think a lot of people know much about this history. So the great part about your book is that you have demarcated like the different locations throughout the different states about, you know, where they are, you know, about you know, where the actual settlements are, because what it really goes to show is that, you know, African Americans have been in and around pretty much every single region in the United States. And so even though the contemporary there might not be, you know, extremely high amounts of folks living in particular places, that when we speak about the Great Migration, that Isabel Wilkerson, I think, is the woman who wrote the book, The Warmth of Other Suns, I think, is the title of the book. But as great as that book is, and obviously that's a tremendous book, that there's so many other stories to be told. And it's why historians, well, I wouldn't say all historians are going to be employed, because we all know how the job market is, but there are always stories to be told. Let's say that. Right. I think that's a safe assumption to make.
Well, I think that I'm in agreement with wonderful historians like Charles LaRoche and Stephen Vincent, who were also pioneers in this field, that there is so much more to be found. There is so much more that's buried, even in the Northeast, even in the frontier and rural Northeast. It reminds me of that wonderful novel, A Mercy, by Toni Morrison, where she's describing frontier Virginia in the 1680s and 1690s, and she does an amazing job capturing the confusion and complication and diversity of the peoples who lived in that region at that time. These were the roots of some of these pioneering families, right? Many of whom could trace their freedom back to the 1600s. And what she gets at and what we can understand is that diversity is a baseline in the New World, right? And it is segregation that is the violently created norm. Once it's created, it takes real will and force to overcome. But diversity is actually the baseline. It is the norm. And I feel like even sort of within corporate America today, like we talk about diversity training or as if it's an add-on, but it actually was not originally an add-on in America. It was destroyed, and we may have to work to regain it. But also, integration does not equal equality, right? This is really, really important. And it's very important what happened in the 1960s. But if we can learn anything from the history of slavery, it's that integration does not equal equality, because, of course, the system of slavery was an incredibly integrated and intimate system. It was just a system of horrific injustice and misuse of power. But integration in itself is not an answer. Equality is the answer.
And that is definitely very true, because, you know, you had mentioned a little bit ago about, you know, how the Klan, that to you it's no surprise, I believe is what you said, that the Klan is, you know, it may have been started in Pulaski, Tennessee, on the heels of the Civil War. But it was a very I can't speak of contemporary, so I won't make that leap. But its influence in, you know, areas that you mentioned in the book, that definitely is unquestioned. And so, you know, the legacy of backlash in the United States is definitely not a contemporary one. It has historical legs, the particular genealogical record to be brought about. In the latter portion of your book, when you speak about the in the conclusion area, you speak about that a bit as well.
Yeah, that is something that I really hope historians will work on further, because there's long been sort of a confusion about this region, the Midwest, and the rise in the rural regions of the Klan. But it seems no coincidence to me that they arose, and they arose with particular fierce virulence around some of the oldest and most successful of these pioneering settlements. And so I feel like oftentimes the term North and South are bandied about in ways sort of they're meant to read. Southern is often translated in newspapers today as sort of meaning a certain type of white racism. Northern means a certain type of sort of liberalism. But there were, you know, one of the most infamous and horrific lynchings that occurred in the 20th century that gave rise to the song Strange Fruit, that really amazing and terrible photograph of the two men hanging from the tree with whites underneath pointing up at them as if they're in a party, is Marion, Indiana. Mm-hmm. It's not Mississippi. And that county of Indiana had a thriving early pioneer community in it that had a AME church by the 1840s. So the history of backlash, the history of lynching, you know, there is a reason why these regions have lost many of these, bless you, have lost many of these settlements.
Yeah. Excuse me, y'all. That's actually very true. Especially, in light of the recent museum and memorial site down in Montgomery, Alabama, through the work of Brian Stevenson and the Equal Justice Initiative, is, you know, that he, a part of his work was going to lynching sites and taking a sediment, taking ground from it to be able to deposit it back in the memorial site. And I think that is so profound, because it's a way of recognizing the pain and recognizing that when we talk about, you know, the push for integration and the push for equality, more importantly, that, you know, but I thought integration already happened. Well, hey, yeah. You know, which one do you really want? I would much rather have an equal society, because I think that's something that's a larger a freedom dream, as the great Robin Kelly would talk about.
Right.
And so,
and you know that part. The project of that museum is so incredibly important because it deals with another form of buried history, right? Another form of forgetting. But in some ways, what was happening in the Northwest Territory, that act of forgetting, that act of burying has been so successful that it is, we're only just now, right, beginning to unbury it. But it doesn't make less important the martyrdom and murder of successful African-American entrepreneurs in this region long before the Civil War or just after the Civil War, less important. I think it is essential that we realize that it happened there too. There needs to be a reckoning. This truth needs to be unburied as well. And we need to honor people like the wealthy farmer who in Dark County, Ohio, in the 1870s had a group of white men with masks over their heads surround his farmhouse at night and start shooting into it and murdered him. This is not about North versus South, right? This is a national, This is a national issue. And I often think about Desmond Tutu's Truth and Reconciliation, right? Mm-hmm, we do need to have the truth first.
Yep. And there cannot be any reconciliation if there's no truth. And that's why the truth of someone, two people with historical time in the Midwest, one being Ida B. Wells, who in her chronicle, in her path-breaking work on lynching statistics, well before anyone else ever did it, she was a pioneer in that sense, how she said that it was not necessarily the poor African Americans that were being lynched, though there were poor African Americans lynched. It was those folks who were deemed as quote unquote successful, that those were some of the folks who were largely being murdered and assailed and removed from areas. And so there's that part, but also someone like Malcolm X, who is from Omaha, Nebraska, and had lived in Michigan, said that, we should stop talking about the South, because if you're south of the Canadian border, you're South. Because what, Malcolm was doing was saying that the entire nation is complicit, because if we're going to say that we are a nation, then we should be accountable for the entirety of it. And that includes the atrocities that go on, not only in the South, but also throughout the other regions of the nation. Because in my understanding of history is also, if the particular narrative of a particular atrocity is only seen through the lens of a singular location, then everywhere else it occurs will be deemed as lesser than when judged from the most malignant part of that tumor.
That's an interesting point, Adam, because it surprised me when I was looking at the rise of violence in cities and urban areas of the North in the 1830s, is that in each case, when described in urban histories, there are localized reasons that are described for that particular event, whether it's, the Ohio River, there wasn't a lot of rain and the Ohio River dried up, so there were a lot of like rivermen in Cincinnati in this time, or there were a lot of Irish people coming into New York City, or there's always a local reason, when in reality, this was a national event that was occurring. And as I point out in my book, it was often leaders, it was senators and mayors, newspapermen, sheriffs, justices of the peace who were organizing these acts of violence against middle-class and successful African-Americans in this wave of backlash. But I want to stress that this is a two-part story, right? The first one is the rising, and then the second part is the backlash. But if we lose the history of that first advancement, the first fervor for freedom, the first abolitionist movement, which, Ira Berlin rightly calls the slow emancipation. Rest in peace. Right, the slow emancipation. You know, obviously people were held enslaved in New Jersey when the Civil War broke out. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, this was an emancipation movement that resulted in entire slave states tipping towards freedom and entire states, most of the nation, tipping towards equality for a generation. That unless we understand that portion of it, we can't understand the backlash.
And thank you for that portion that you just mentioned. I think our listeners would definitely appreciate that our last, 10 minutes. So I really, that's a great cherry on top to that. And so now that this book is completed and it is ready to be out there for the folks to read it, which believe me, you will see a surge in the numbers because of this interview. I'm claiming it. I'm claiming that. And so nevertheless, what now that this is over, what else can we expect from you down the line? Because I know that this book is definitely something that is definitely an important work. And going forward, what other projects are you involved in? Because I know that you talked about your work at the Smithsonian. What other projects in public history or in written texts are you going to be involved in down the line?
Well, I have to admit there's so much that has come out of this project. Again, mm-hmm. when I say 100 historians could take 100 years and not cover it all, I've been almost overwhelmed with choices of what to do for my next project, but it's kind of up to my editor. And at the moment we are in conversation about my next project. So I'm afraid that's between me, my editor, and my agent, unfortunately.
That is okay. That's A-okay.
know that I am moving forward definitely working on a couple of different ideas, but I certainly hope that more will enter this field because it is a massive field and it needs more hands to the plow.
Well, I definitely will be someone who will definitely hope to put his hands on the plow, like the great Mahalia Jackson once said in one of her spirituals. And so, going forward, I definitely appreciate you sitting down with us today to be able to speak about this tremendous book, The Bone and Sinew of the Land. Yep. America's Forgotten Black Pioneers and the Struggle for Equality. And once again, this is published by Public Affairs Press. And we will definitely have you on the program. I surely hope so. Whenever your next book comes for publication. And just know that you have friends over here at the New Books Network's African American Studies channel.
Thank you, Adam. You did a wonderful job. It's been my pleasure.
Very good. And so until next time, this is Adam McNeil speaking with Dr. Anna Lisa Cox.
Yes.
And so we are definitely appreciative of the time that we spent with her today. And until next time, folks, African American Studies Channel, over and out.